Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this, the latest in the OIS podcast series. This is the sixth podcast that we are doing on the impact of the energy markets of the Russia-Ukraine crisis. And with me today are Mike Forward, Senior Research Fellow, and Jack Sharples, Research Fellow. And we'll be discussing gas markets and what has been going on over the last 7 days or so. Now, in this ever-changing world, I just want to timestamp the recording of this podcast, which we are doing at 1200 hours London time on May the 10th, 2022. Now, last week's podcast was recorded from the Flame Conference in Amsterdam, so it will be interesting to hear from Mike and Jack about more reflections from that industry get-together. But before we do that, let's talk about prices, flows, and storage. So let's start with you, Mike. Mike, can you give us an update on the latest price movements and what is happening on Gazprom's insistence on ruble payments for its gas?
Yes, thank you, David. Almost uniquely, not much has changed on the pricing front since we recorded last week's podcast. I mean, prices sort of stabilised, you know, around about the 100 euros a megawatt hour level, or $30 a million BTU if you're using that currency. And it's kind of stayed there over the last week. In fact, in the last couple of days, they've weakened a bit more, and they weakened a bit more this morning. So they were actually down sort of about 2 or 3% early morning. So they're about 93 euros a megawatt hour. So that's for TTF. And the obviously we noted last week that NBP is at a big discount to TTF. That's continuing. We've got constraints on the sort of interconnector. First of all, the amount of gas going into the interconnector and BBL for export was very high. And now they've had some problems with liquids, which are sort of being sorted this week. And also the LNG prices into Northwest Europe are also at a big discount to TTF, but still sort of higher than the JKM prices. Regarding the ruble payments, we're still a bit in wait and see mode. I mean, Gazprom issued, we saw on the press, sort of a reassurance on that the fact that the guidance suggested by the EU, you know, may be able to let people comply with this without breaching sanctions. And it's still a little bit unclear on this, but I think Finland said they weren't going to pay in rubles, and they're obviously quite exposed to Russian flows. So I think the market is in a wait-and-see moment. And I think the big things, which I think we'll talk about towards the end of next week, first of all, the mid-May payments, probably due next week on most of the Gazprom contracts. So interested to see what happens there. And the EU is supposed to publish in more detail on its plan, in inverted commas, on May the 18th. So I think people are waiting to see what happens next week, and then there might be a lot more news then.
Well, thanks, Mike. So, Jack, wanted to come to you. You know, and I think the question I'd like to pose is, you know, are the shift in prices, particularly the relationship between the front month and the day ahead, actually having any impact on flows?
Yeah, so I think this is something Mike and I have been looking at for a couple of months now, really, that in terms of Russian gas flows to Europe, it's very clear that Gazprom is now, to say that it's not an active participant to any great degree in the European spot market would be putting it diplomatically, let's say. But what this does mean is that the physical flow of Russian gas to Europe on a day-to-day basis is being determined by nominations by Gazprom's long-term contract counterparties. And here we are seeing some of this balance between spot prices and what we take to be a bit of a rough estimate as to what some of those contract prices might be, determining some of these flows and nominations. So actually, in the present context, we've seen the total Russian flow to Europe decline throughout April from around 360 million cubic metres per day at the end of March down to a low of about 245 million cubic metres per day at the end of April. Now, in the past week, this has recovered and has averaged just over 300 million cubic metres per day since the 2nd of May. Now, to put that into a bit of year-on-year context, that's still 125 million cubic metres per day down on where we were in the first week of May last year. So that's a year-on-year decline of around 30%. So that may go some way towards explaining still some of this market tightness in Europe and some of these pricing levels. In terms of how that Russian gas is arriving, the Nord Stream pipeline has been at full capacity since the end of March. where we've seen fluctuations have been on the Yamal Europe line into Poland from Belarus. Obviously, that as measured on that Poland-Belarus border came to zero when Poland was cut off on the 27th of April. It did recover briefly for several days at the start of May, but has since fallen back to zero. Elsewhere, since late March, the flows from Turkey into Greece, originating in the Turkstream pipeline, fluctuated within a corridor of 20 to 40 million cubic metres per day, and then actually gained from the bottom of that corridor up towards the upper end at the beginning of May. So that's somewhere else that we've seen a gain in the past week. That's primarily delivered into Bulgaria, Greece, Serbia and Hungary. Now, the largest growth in Russian supply in the last week has been delivered via Ukraine, where we've seen a gain of around 30 million cubic metres per day in the last week or so, from around 60 million cubic metres per day at the end of April to around 90 million cubic metres per day at the present level. Now, the flows from Ukraine into Hungary, Romania and Poland are all at zero. So all of this gain is actually through a central corridor into Slovakia, where gas is delivered onto Austria and Italy. So those are the target markets where Gazprom's counterparties are nominating up and determining some of these flows. Now, if we look to some of the other pipeline suppliers, the picture is less dynamic. So flows into southern Europe remain pretty flat, about 100 million cubic metres per day coming in from North Africa into Spain and Italy, and around 30 million cubic metres per day from Azerbaijan flowing to Greece via Turkey. The flows from Norway remain higher than those from Russia, as they have been pretty much since Christmas, with the exception of the 3 weeks following the launch of the Russian invasion of Ukraine and a couple of days at the end of March. So as things stand, technically speaking, Norway is the largest pipeline supplier to Europe instead of Russia. Now, those flows from Norway did dip in April, but they climbed after the Russian cutoff to Poland, presumably compensating there. On the 8th of May, the Norwegian flow to Europe was around 320 million cubic metres per day, which is around 25 million cubic metres per day higher than the Russian flow. So that's where we sit in terms of pipeline supplies overall. A bit of reaction to the Russian cutoffs to Poland and Bulgaria on the 27th of April, but generally speaking, a definite uptick at the beginning of May.
Well, fantastic, Jack, for that incredible overview. Mike, can I come to you? Why don't we talk about LNG for a minute? You know, what is the outlook for LNG from May into Europe looking like?
Yeah, it's still pretty buoyant. I mean, as we noted last week, in the first 4 months, LNG into wider Europe, including Turkey, is about 20 billion cubic metres higher than last year. And we're probably on target to reach about 40 BCM rise for the year as a whole. It's not too difficult to achieve that. But in terms of the May, it's still looking quite buoyant, but it's probably going to be lower than it was in April, which was quite strong. In terms of the exports globally, there was quite a significant rise in April in terms of the supply coming to the market, a lot of which gets delivered in May. So there's sort of a lag between the exports and imports. It does look as though, China was quite weak in April in terms of its imports. So they made maybe a little bit better, although still mean it's down year on year compared to what it was. It was because it was very strong in 2021. Similarly, Japan, Korea, Taiwan may not be too bad. But Southeast Asia seems to be roaring ahead in terms of its need for LNG imports. It's well up year on year in the first 4 months, and May is looking fairly similar. But also, I think we're going to see a little bit of bounce back, certainly compared to April in South America, especially probably in Argentina and Chile, for example. So outside Europe, there's a little bit of a bounce back happening. I think in terms of what's coming into Europe in May, it's going to be higher than last year, but probably down a little bit on the April numbers, which were fairly strong. And Jack was saying, obviously, pipeline flows being pretty robust as well. The market is looking reasonably well supplied, I think, overall.
Well, Jack, you've actually been looking at some stats, haven't you, on European LNG terminals. Do you want to share some of kind of your conclusions with our listeners?
Yeah, sure. So looking at the daily data for both offloadings into European LNG terminals, and here I exclude Turkey, and then comparing that with some of the daily send-out data from those terminals, so that's LNG being regasified and injected into the national pipeline systems in those countries. In the first 8 days of May, daily LNG imports, so that is cargo offloadings, were sustained at levels even higher than those in April. But the send-out did drop from around 480 million cubic metres per day in late April to just under 400 million cubic metres per day at present. Now, as a result, LNG storage stocks are rising. So on the 8th of May, we had about 4 BCM in storage at LNG terminals, which is about 70% of their storage capacity. And here I can pass the conversation back to you guys with your long years of LNG experience, let's say, that if we compare this to underground gas storage facilities, well, 70% full isn't, you know, exactly touching tank tops. But in terms of LNG import terminals, that actually is quite a high level.
Mike, do you want to comment on that? Certainly, I would argue 70% is high, and of course, we still have to keep operational levels for vessels to arrive. What's your view on that?
Yeah, I mean, you can probably squeeze a little bit more in there, but I mean, as soon as say 160,000 cubic meter tanker turns up at the LNG terminal, you want to offload it, which means you've got to start sending stuff out, even at probably 70% utilization. So I think from that perspective, 70% makes it quite tight in terms of receiving other cargoes.
Well, staying with you, you know, what about kind of possible issues on LNG into the UK, say, in June to August period?
OK, right. This is where I need a partner and engineering degree to try and explain this. It's an interesting discussion I've had over the last couple of weeks with people, but essentially, if you think of the capacity of a pipeline system is only as high as the demand for gas being taken off. So you're not taking the gas out of the system, you can't get the gas into the system, basically, is the starting point. So typically in the summer months in the UK, let's say June to August, which is the kind of warmest month, clear demand is way, way lower than it is in the winter. It's going to be three times as high in the December to February period as it is in the to June to August period. And traditionally, LNG coming into the UK is at probably very, very low levels in that period because we don't necessarily need the LNG. Obviously, one of the issues is that what we've seen over the last few months is huge exports down the interconnector and BBL to the continent when we'd normally be importing gas from the mainland Europe. Because the UK, as we've said, it was before the Ukraine invasion started, that the UK uses a land bridge to effectively send the LNG to Europe. Now, the problem is, with low levels of demand, you basically, for northern and eastern parts of Great Britain, you've got to bring gas in at St Fergus, Easington and Bacton. So to satisfy that demand, you can probably run Isle of Grain at reasonably high levels because that sort of satisfies demand in the southern bit. But that causes problems at Milford Haven because there's simply nowhere for the regasified LNG to go because there's not enough demand for it. So there's been some discussion with Ofgem and National Grid about constraining firm entry capacity at Milford Haven simply because the system can't take it. That's never been a problem before, because obviously demand is very low. But if there's a demand for LNG into Europe to re-export down the interconnector at very high levels, which we've seen, then it's actually quite difficult or possibly impossible to bring that amount of LNG in. So the UK could get very constrained in terms of its ability to take LNG at Milford Haven during these summer months, which actually, depending on what is going to happen at the other Northwest Europe LNG terminals, could constrain LNG coming into the European market if they're still running flat out. So we could see, on that basis, a tail off in LNG imports into Northwest Europe, including the UK, during the summer months. That may not be too bad if Russia flows continue, but if there are curtailments, then that could make the situation worse. If you get back to the winter, everything's fine because demand on the system is so high, you can run, you know, you can run Milford Haven flat out and Isle of Grain flat out and still sort of take the LNG in. Complex topic, but I think it's something to sort of watch out for. Jack, you want to add anything there?
Yeah, I think just to add into that, obviously Mike was saying that come the winter with a bit of surge in seasonal gas demand in the UK, then that situation will ease. Something else that we are looking forward to later into the year is the launch of the Baltic Pipe from Norway via Denmark to Poland. Now, the UK gets a lot of its Norwegian gas on a spot basis. And of course, what will flow from Norway to Poland via the Baltic Pipe will be contracted, which means that that will take precedence. So we think that there could be a decline in Norwegian pipeline flows to the UK. So again, that could open up a bit of space in the UK market for additional LNG.
Certainly, the message I'm hearing is you know, the jury is out. We need to watch how this is going to happen, particularly because, of course, the pipeline link between South Hook and Milford Haven in Wales and the west of the country has some limits on its capacity on that link pipeline into the NTS, the National Transmission System. Why don't we move our discussion away from LNG for a minute? But maybe you raised gas storage earlier on, Jack, so why don't we go to that? You know, what is the status of the gas state of storage in Europe, you know, relative to targets and, say, last year?
Well, again, I feel like my message in each of these podcasts is sort of a cautious optimism, let's say, or at least not crushing pessimism, let me put it that way. But I do rather feel as if we are waiting for the blow to fall somewhere along the line. So European storage stocks, so that is EU plus UK, are now just under 38 BCM. Now, a week ago, we were 3 BCM higher year on year. Now we are 5 BCM higher year on year. But remember that 2021 was a bit of an odd year in the sense that we really drew down our storage stocks in the first quarter as LNG was redirected away to Northeast Asia. And in fact, we did rather lose April as a net injection month last year. April was not particularly unseasonably cold, but it just never really got warm either. So we didn't move into fully fledged injection mode until the beginning of May last year. Whereas I think even with the pricing signals not particularly looking brilliant in terms of motivating storage, if you're looking to make a profit from it, comparing the, you know, the current price and the forward price, we are seeing very strong sort of political imperatives, let's say, and policy pushes to get gas into storage, and it does appear to be happening. Now, of course, we simply need to keep watching this on pretty much on a week by week basis, really, to see whether we remain on track to hit 80% full by the 1st of November. At present, we are on track for that, but of course, anything could happen over the summer. We are watching what may happen with the ruble payment scheme and the physical flow of Russian gas to Europe. What could happen over the summer, for example, if it's particularly hot or dry elsewhere in the world, and there is a boost in the need for gas for power generation and feeding into air conditioning units. And as Mike has said as well, if actually, as the demand sort of slumps a little bit, particularly in the UK during the summer months, if we face any particular bottlenecks around getting LNG into Europe for the express purpose of injecting it into storage. So there's very definitely different pieces at play, let's say, different factors at play going through the summer. So for now, I will say a bit of cautious optimism, but it remains tentative.
And I have to say, I hope as we record more of these podcasts, specifically on the Russia-Ukraine situation, your optimism continues. I fear that it may not, but anyway. Well, look, as mentioned earlier in this week's podcast recording, you know, last week's podcast was made on actually day one of the annual Flame Conference in Amsterdam. So let me end this podcast by asking both of you, what were the reflections on the conference as a whole? So, Mike, why don't I come to you first?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. I noticed early on in the LNG summit, there's quite a few LNG suppliers. Talks and panels sort of was saying, yeah, here we are, we can sign long-term contracts with us. We're all looking forward to that. And But I think there's a little bit of a sort of dichotomy in Europe in terms of, you know, and only a few weeks ago they've been told not to sign long-term contracts in energy transition. Now they've been encouraged to sign long-term contracts, but not 20 years. So there's a bit of a disconnect here between what the suppliers want and what the buyers want. And I think I'd imagine the European buyers are sort of pretty confused. And I understand from sort of press reports that the Qatar-Germany talks aren't going very well because the Qataris are insisting on all indexation destination clauses. No chance that'll happen in the European market. The other thing I think on the contract side was there was a fascinating panel discussion on the Gazprom contracts into the EU. It does appear that governments in the EU seem to have little recognition of the impact of contracts on the flows, wanting to reduce Russian imports. And there was a real very, very good discussion on the possibility of sanctions. And I think the conclusion I took away from that sanctions on Russian gas would be very difficult to implement, especially if you need unanimity amongst the EU member states. And even if you could, the possibility of claiming force majeure with the buyers actually could be quite problematic. So I think could be another watch this space in terms of the Gazprom contracts of the EU.
Mike, actually, if I just add one thing to your LNG points, because on one of the panels I chaired, I think we had an intervention from CPC in Taiwan, another one we had from IEJ in Japan. And I think it was a genuine concern about the ability to secure LNG cargoes at a reasonable price. Because, of course, the alternative may be limited for Asian buyers, or you turn to coal or in nuclear in some occasions, which in neither country is that popular. So I think there was a genuine concern about price and availability of supply as the situation in Europe is so uncertain. Well, look, Jack, let me come to you. You know, just, you know, what were your views and takeaways kind of and reflections on the conference as a whole?
Well, I think another interesting point of discussion was how the present market situation is effectively being stress tested. It's stress testing the infrastructure that we have and the ability of the market to cope and provide the right signals. And one of the takeaways that I was particularly intrigued by is this reemergence of pricing differentials between national markets being driven by bottlenecks in trying to move gas around from one point to another. So Mike has already alluded to this in terms of the BBL and interconnector between the UK and continental Europe, pretty much running flat out and then facing obviously some short-term issues, but the result being, of course, that NBP disconnected and fell to a discount of TTF. It's something else that we've seen, something else that Mike and I raised in a paper a couple of months ago about Europe's ability to import more LNG, noting that there is, you know, the most plentiful spare LNG regasification capacity is on the Iberian Peninsula, but of course there is a significant bottleneck in terms of moving that gas across the border from Spain into France. So I think that definitely this re-emergence, if you like, of some national distinctions was one interesting point. Obviously, the question of what's going to happen in the next several weeks in terms of the ruble payment scheme, I think very much everybody's view of what may happen on the European gas market in the coming months was every utterance was heavily caveated around the notion of let's assume that Russian gas continues to flow into Europe at take or pay levels. If it doesn't, if there are substantial cutoffs, then all bets are off in terms of any plans for accumulating storage stocks, any forecasts for prices, and just generally, I think, some of the short-term functioning of the European market. But I would add as well that I did hear from several people that in the face of proposals for, you know, collective gas purchases or capping of wholesale prices, what I heard from market participants at Flame was let the market work. That the reason that we have the flow of LNG into Europe at the present levels is that prices are attracting those cargoes. So I think, Mike, you may wish to add to that.
Yeah, basically, I think it was said by a number of people, I mean, the market's worked as it was supposed to work. I mean, people may not, governments and the EU may not like the outcome, but that's the market has worked. And almost everything that, to be honest, governments and people have said a bit more to disrupt the market and cause higher prices than if they just let things alone and let the market work.
Well, I'm just going to add 2 points, if I can, on a couple of reflections on flame from my perspective. First of all, is kind of the role of government versus the market. And I think we started to see government interventions kind of politically, but also perhaps underpinning some of the new regasification capacity, which is being developed in Germany. And I think there was a view as to how far does that go. The message really being given by the players was government should set the regulations when the market should ultimately operate within those regulations. And my second takeaway was more longer term, and that is just the fundamental view by most of the participants that we are really facing a paradigm shift of energy supply in Europe. And this will end up in a real change in medium to long-term gas flows. And I know that's something that we will continue to monitor and report on from the OIES. Well, look, thank you very much, both of you. We've come to the end of our time today. Your contributions, as normal, were excellent. So thank you very much indeed. And to our listeners, please go to our website to see our recent research from Jack and Mike, as well, of course, as our other researchers and programmes. So just for now, thank you to you all for listening. Take care of yourself and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.